Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in...
Well, guess what, folks? We moles are rooting those mountains down. And this mole radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, non-commercial, utterly non-corporate, the antidote to corporatism, nearly entirely listener-supported, democratically run, independent radio. This beautiful Monday, it's the first Monday of our membership drive, when we ask you, our listeners, and this whole wonderful community of Portland to support the radio station that supports you, that supports the struggles of working people, women, people of color, those oppressed because of their sexuality, and so many others. We are the voice of social, economic, environmental justice. We show another better world, a democratic and sustainable world, that it's possible. And of course, fighting for that better world is absolutely necessary because the lords of commerce, they are relentless. Relentless in their drive to exploit the whole earth and space too, and all life, including human life, of course. Nothing is sacred in their insatiable pursuit of wealth, power, control. It may sound apocalyptic, grandiose, but what stands in their way of the corporate Leviathan, the only force that can save this planet, in fact, it's us old moles, organizing here in Portland, organizing all over the U.S., organizing internationally to build a wholly different economic system dedicated to the health and welfare of the planet, its living legacy. That's what we discuss on KBOO, the perilous situation of the people and the planet. But not just the depredations of the elites and the wealthy and the corporations. We talk about sustainable democratic solutions brought to you by old moles. KBOO is the lead voice of critique, hope, and action here in Portland. We are now asking you during our membership drive to support this radio station. Join us. Become a member. Do your part. Call 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266 and do it during this show. Today on The Mole, we look at the media, specifically the decline of what's called the old media and the birth of a new, richer, independent, uncensored media. So today on The Mole, I'm Bill Resnick, your host. Today I talked to Bob McChesney, who did the book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. And this new book is a gift today for those who call in and become members. Our number again, 503-232-8818. Today, old moles Laurie Mercier and Fran Michel review Michael Moore's latest work, his sensational film, Capitalism, A Love Story. First on today's mole, Laurie Mercier interviews Jesse Walker, who wrote the book Rebels on the Air, An Alternative History of Radio.
And with me is Jesse Walker, authors of Rebels on the Air. Welcome to KBOO, Jesse.
Glad to be here.
Let me introduce you, Jesse, first. Jesse Walker is the managing editor of Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He is a former DJ and has written on topics ranging from pirate radio to copyright law for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Z, and numerous other publications. And today on The Old Mole, we're focusing on the old and new media and want to talk with him about his book, Rebels on the Air, An Alternative History of Radio in America, which traces the origins of community radio and the government and corporate roadblocks that have attempted to limit its reach. And Jesse, in your book, you describe an enormous creativity and experimentation in the 1960s and early 1970s when community radio activists, including Lewis Hill, who helped launch KPFA FM in Berkeley, and the Pacifica Foundation, which would go on to establish stations across the country, and Lorenzo Milam, the Johnny Appleseed of community radio, who had a hand in starting Crab FM in Seattle and our own KBOO here in Portland. What happened to make these experiments in community radio more difficult?
Radio, and I should say Lewis Hill was a little bit earlier than Lorenzo Milam, but he was sort of a granddaddy of it because Lorenzo Milam worked for Lou Hill's station in Berkeley, and that helped inspire him to create CRAB or KRAB in Seattle. But what really changed is, it's not the only time there's this burst of experimentation, and it might help just to compare it to what happened in the 50s, because in the 50s, when TV came along and all the sorts of programmings people had on the radio migrated to TV, you know, sitcoms and the stuff that was just dominating mainstream radio, people suddenly had all this space, and they were forced, and they were losing listeners, and they were forced to experiment. And then when FM opened up in the 60s, and it had technically been existing earlier, but the FCC had restricted it and had actually moved it from one part of the dial to another one part of the spectrum to another, making everyone's radios useless. So they had done a lot of things just to hobble the growth of FM to protect the people on AM from competition, mostly. Is that it was this big space that mostly people weren't doing anything with. And that allowed people to experiment. And this happened to coincide with the ferment of the 60s, so a lot of people had ideas for how they wanted to experiment. And you had, you know, community radio taking off. Then you also had on the commercial band people experimenting with freeform. It's hard to imagine a commercial freeform station in most markets today, but that actually for a few years was kind of a common as some big companies that had no idea how to appeal to countercultural listeners and decided just to hire a bunch of people, in some cases people from community radio, to do their programming for them.
Because the independent creative radio was sort of pushing commercial radio in that direction, right?
Yeah, I mean, the idea was, you know, we don't know what to do, we might as well let these guys play. And then once they found, hey, they can make a lot of money with FM, you know, they started bringing in more controls over what the stations could do there. So on the one hand, you have these new controls coming on within the stations. The other problem was that the band was filling up. And this is what keeps ending these periods of experimentations, is that you keep eventually running up against the barriers of how much space there is for people to communicate. The problem is there's much more space than the government allows people to use. I mean, you could have many, many more radio stations on the FM dial right now without causing significant interference than you have right now. But the people who, you know, currently possess the radio stations that are there now, who own the licenses, do not want to deal with the competition for listeners, and they don't want to deal with the competition for advertisers, although I would argue that with that much room, you would have a bias towards non-commercial and even amateur stations. So there's that's the larger problem, is that the FCC doesn't allow all the people who could go on the air to go on the air. And that's why we saw the micro-radio movement in the 90s. A lot of people said, well, if we can't get licenses, we're going to go on the air anyway and broadcast and invite the FCC to bust us and you know, have essentially a movement for civil disobedience to have more free speech on the airwaves.
Now this movement to restrict the airwaves began in the mid-1970s?
It has existed for as long as there have been government regulations of the airwaves. I mean, it's always been regulated on behalf of the people who are the dominant players in the industry. So you could go back to the founding of the FCC, actually before the founding of the FCC in the 1930s. When the Federal Radio Commission was created in the late 1920s, the first order of business was deciding, well, how are we going to divvy up the airwaves? And they made a conscious decision. And I know you're going to have Robert McChesney on the show this hour. He talks about this a lot in his first book, that they were going to prefer what they called general interest stations over what they called propaganda stations. And propaganda station meant anything done from a particular point of view. So if a station was run by a union, by a church, by a nonprofit, they were discriminated against. If you had a broad-based network station, you know, like CBS and NBC affiliate, then that was going to be the beneficiary. When FM came along, a similar procedure happened with, AM powers that be, you know, making sure their friends at the FCC made things difficult for FM. In particular, RCA was trying to control the patents for FM and didn't have it, and there was a revolving door that worked to RCA's benefit. So I mean, so what happened in the 1970s was simply that, you know, they found that FM could be profitable. They found that long-haired kids listening to rock music were a market to be served, so people started investing more in FM. And a lot of these stations were already owned by, you know, big companies that were less averse to experimentation once they had figured out a formula that they thought worked. But they didn't have that extra space for the independent people to go on and keep experimenting, or they didn't have nearly enough space because of all these enclosures and barriers that had already been put in place in the law long before then.
Now, Jesse, you also write about how many radio activists sought government funding, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and National Public Radio were created then. But then how did the conditions of funding affect the nature of independent radio?
Oh, in all sorts of ways. I mean, you know, they come with strings attached. And I actually, KBOO, was the director of KBOO, was one of the people who protested the first bunch of strings that were attached when the Corporation for Public Broadcasting started distributing the money. The nature of the strings has varied over the years, but they often involve having a certain amount of professional staff, reaching a certain number of listeners going as according to the ratings that are used by commercial stations, which is not the only way to measure audiences. And in general, it frequently set up a treadmill so that stations would, in order to get government money, would have to spend a lot of money in order to hire that extra staff and professionalize, and that in turn made them dependent on the money that they were receiving from the government. And then they would say, well, we're changing our rules for how you're going to give out the money. We're going to have, you know, a healthy station project that, you know, encourages you to professionalize more. Perhaps, you know, get away from having all these different kinds of shows that don't mix well together. We want to have just one streamlined sort of programming throughout the day. And a lot of stations, as a result, in community radio, went through pitched battles over how they were going to structure themselves, what the nature of the station would be, what the soul of the station would be.
Well, you mentioned micro radio as a movement in the 1990s. I mean, what have been some of the bright spots or models in terms of independent radio in the past decade?
In the 90s or in the last decade?
Well, in the last decade, yeah, since the 90s. And where do you think we're headed in terms of experimental and independent radio?
Well, I have to say the most exciting stuff is happening online right now because, again, that's the space where people can experiment. And that's also a space that the FCC, they have regulations on certain levels of what goes on with telecommunications industry. But in terms of content, there aren't any FCC controls. What they have, the main part of the government they have to worry about is the Copyright Office, actually. And so as a result, you've seen this explosion of creativity online. Now, there are ways that the Internet is very different from AM and FM broadcasting. Lots of Internet radio is not localized. You can have localized Internet radio. There's a lot of localized stuff that happens online. But more of what's really useful and different on the Internet is in terms of either someone playing sorts of music in an intense niche that you can't find elsewhere, or doing freeform, which often you can't find on the radio dial except in places like community radio and college radio. A lot of podcasts are interesting talk shows, and then they often will get picked up in different radio stations around the country, but they tend to be more nationally or globally focused if people put them on as podcasts. Again, there are exceptions. So the bright spot is this immense amount of diversity and experimentation online and the fact that you're able to see, new things you can't do with the old radio medium, and, you know, the flexibility, listening when you want to and so on.
Uh-huh.
But the downside is you can't do a call-in podcast, you know. So much of it is not locally based. There's a lot of stuff that's still very good for a traditional AM or FM station to do. And my hope is that at the same time that we see this, thousand flowers blooming online, we'll still be able to keep the KBOO type stations doing their creative broadcasting.
So community radio then does not necessarily need to see this Internet, the flourishing of Internet activity as competition, but maybe as opportunity.
Oh, it absolutely is opportunity. I mean, I'm not sure if this is true of KBOO, but I know many stations simulcast, online and have listeners in elsewhere, keeping track of what's happening in their old hometowns. You have people getting programming from online, putting, exchange. It used to be in the early 70s when community radio stations were just sprouting up all over the country. They would do what they called bicycling, which was basically meant mailing tapes from one to another so they can play them, a week later on another station. Now you can put something online and a whole bunch of stations can play it or play part of it whenever they want to. And that's a wonderful tool.
Right.
You know, so I think I'm certainly not in any way anti-internet.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Jesse Walker. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And speaking of the internet, the Old Mole has a podcast and also a website with links to the interviewees of the day with Jesse Walker and a link to his book, Rebels on the Air, An Alternative History of Radio in America. And Jesse, we're raising money today to support independent community-powered KBOO. Could you tell us why it's important to support stations like KBOO?
I would say that if you listen to and enjoy a radio station that derives its support primarily from listeners, it's wise to, and you can afford to, then it's wise to become one of the listeners who supports such a station. It's not a model where you're dependent on underwriting. It's not a model where you're depending on advertising. It's not a model where you're dependent on government subsidies. It's a model where, you know, I mean, the person who pays the bills in the driver's seat. And if you want to be in that driver's seat, if you want the listeners to be in the driver's seat, then it's good to support the listener support model.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Jesse Walker.
This is KBOO Radio during our fall membership drive. Stay tuned on this Old Mole Variety Hour for our Old Mole review of Michael Moore's latest film, Capitalism, A Love Story. Next on the Mole, Bob McChesney, whose many books examine U.S. media. His latest, to be published in December, is The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. This book promises a lot, it delivers a lot, and we're offering it today as a gift for a membership pledge. Bob McChesney, the decline of journalism, especially good investigative reporting, it's being attributed to the rise of the internet. You have a very different analysis, and you also have a far different, very radical, and but completely reasonable and exciting proposal for building a rich, independent, very high-quality journalism. Bob, but before we discuss your solutions, how do you understand the decline of journalism?
Well, it's great to be with you, and I should point out, first of all, Bill, that my co-author on this is my dear friend John Nichols, who I've written a lot with, who writes for The Nation, and we wrote the book together. And it's definitely an equal operation between the two of us. You know, I think that what we were disappointed in and have been disappointed in is so many people look at the decline of conventional mainstream newsrooms and journalism as a effect of the internet sort of undermining the business models of traditional commercial news media or the effect of the economic crisis demolishing advertising, and that these are really the twin blades that have put journalism in the precarious position it is now and going forward. And in our argument, this really is misses the big picture, that this is not a crisis that's been a few months or a few years in the making, but it's a crisis that's decades in the making. It owes to the conflict between the public good of journalism and being produced and manufactured under commercial auspices by the profit motive. It's always been a tension, and it's really produced all sorts of problems that have now come to manifest themselves. And what the internet has done, the economic crisis has done, is sort of help push over an already teetering giant.
You know, the internet is attractive to a lot of people, but one of the reasons it's so attractive, and to me, is because journalism has become, that is, mainstream journalism has become so sort of narrow and shallow and not interesting and devoted to entertainment. It seems to me that that drive to entertain audiences for advertisers has really corrupted journalism and driven people away from it.
That's exactly right. In fact, you know, what we demonstrate in the book, and the evidence is pretty powerful, the decline of people reading newspapers or consuming traditional news media didn't begin in the last 10 years with the rise of MySpace and Facebook and the Daily Coast. And it didn't even begin with the rise of the World Wide Web in the early and mid-1990s. It began going back to the 1970s. And the main factor for this is that the companies that owned our news media increasingly saw this as an area where you could gut expenses to newsrooms, to labor, to journalists, and convert it more to a cash cow, and the quality of the product went way down, and increasingly newspapers and news in general, commercial news, became of less value, and as a result, they sort of killed their own market. To give some examples, to put this in context, Norway has probably the most wired country in the world. It's certainly on the short list of most wired countries in terms of people who have broadband access and spend time on the internet. Yet it still has, you know, three or four times the daily newspaper consumption of the United States per person. I mean, people read papers, still do. Young people still read newspapers there, even though they're all online. Because there, for a variety of reasons, newspapers are still seen as relevant to the world people live in. And so the problems we have here aren't just due to the internet. If our newspapers were doing great work, they would be doing a lot better today, and our commercial newsrooms on radio and TV would be doing a lot better today, and they'd be able to segue to a digital future rather than die of what looks like a certain, near certain death in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, the internet actually depends on the newspapers. I mean, that's one of your arguments, I gather, that really good journalism doesn't come from bloggers. It comes from a real investigative culture. And it can't be just short. These are long-term kinds of commitments.
Yeah, journalism requires institutions with the strength to stand up to powerful forces and paid working journalists who are fact-checked, copy-edited, who compete, who are accountable for their stories. It doesn't guarantee good journalism, but it's essential to have anything remotely close to good journalism. You know, you simply can't work a day job, then go home and feed your kids and clean your house, and then sit down at 11 p.m. and blog on North Korea and be any good. I mean, it's just not possible. You need someone who actually has the time, resource, and support to do it. Now, that doesn't mean there's not a phenomenal role for bloggers to revolutionize our journalism by participating in it. And we're big fans of that. But bloggers are like the improvisers, and journalists and newsrooms are sort of like the rhythm section of the band. You need the rhythm section, or else you just get a lot of noise.
This is Cable Radio. Thanks, Bob. We're going to move towards our Cable Radio, your Old Mole Variety Hour. Bob McChesney, we're going to move towards our pledge break. But you hold on, and in fact, even join us in the membership break. We'll conclude the interview, though, after this membership break. It's about the conclusion will be about Bob's radical, interesting proposals that journalism and investigative reporting are like public education. They're absolutely vital. They need public support. Before we conclude on that note, first, let's talk about KABU and why it's so socially important and personally and politically important and personally fulfilling to step up now and become a member. We ask you to donate $5 or $10 or $20 a month to keep this Mole radio station on the air and inspiring our community. And as a gift, we want to offer Bob McChesney's forthcoming book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. Bob, I know that you've worked actually in alternative radio. Tell us why it's so important.
Yeah, I started, my media career started as doing a show on WORT in Madison, the sort of KABU's sister station in Madison, a community station, and it since has evolved. When I moved to Illinois, I used the tapes I had from Madison to get a weekly show on the NPR affiliate in Illinois, which I've been doing for the last 7 years. And I'm a huge fan of community radio, and I think, you know, as I travel around the country, towns that have really good community stations like KABU, I don't know if people there fully appreciate what a contribution it is. It's when you get to a town that doesn't have one that you really see it. And, you know, I think anyone listening to this show has got to understand that only 10% of the regular listeners to a station like KABU pledge and give money to support the station. And, you know, that calculus has got to change, because the choice for KABU is either to get money from advertisers who will then pick what sort of program you get, or to get it directly from the people of Portland. And the people of Portland and the Portland area have got to simply step up. And it's their turn now, your turn, listening to this right now, to say, okay, I love KABU, it's important, I'd hate to see Portland without it. I'm going to do what I can to support community-run radio, where the programming comes from people who live here, who care about this community and know what they're talking about, and not from the marketing decisions of some Fortune 500 corporation base.
Bob McChesney, let's return to the interview. Why don't we start the second half of the interview with your proposal for a richer, uncensored, far more exciting journalism that will also spark a far more interesting and better informed blogging and websites. Tell us your proposal.
Well, before I do that, let me put it in context, Bill, which is that, you know, most Americans think our free press tradition is one of just having the government stay out of the way and not censor content. And they think, I assume that's all it is. That's what the First Amendment's all about exclusively. That's what the founders had in mind. And there's an element of truth to that. That's certainly a crucial part of our free press tradition. But another part that's every bit as important as the founding of the free press in this country was that the government saw its job as making sure there was a press system in the first place. There was journalism. And as a result of that, we instituted massive printing and postal subsidies in the first century of the country's history, especially in the first 75 years, that spawned a huge print media in the United States, vastly larger than any other country in the world. And that tradition got lost in the shuffle once commercial interests started making a lot of money doing journalism and news, and people just assumed we always would have a commercial media system. But now that the commercial interests, Wall Street and Madison Avenue, are jumping ship and bailing out on journalism, we've got to go back to that other crucial part of our free press tradition, which is the first duty of the state in a democratic society is to make sure you have an independent, functional press system. If you don't have that, you can't have a functional republic. And that's the core principle. In our book, we spent a whole chapter going through this history. It's an extraordinary history, and the amount of the subsidies is mind-boggling. And when you hear what the founders of the Republic were talking about in terms of supporting news and journalism, it really changes your entire view of American press history and what we need to do today. So we think we have to have similarly brilliant, enlightened policies that create an independent, pluralistic press system that doesn't depend on advertisers and owners. It's predominantly nonprofit and non-commercial, but not exclusively, to sort of provide the journalism we need. And there's a number of ways we do that. It's through supporting public and community radio and television, which we call public and community media, because eventually the distinction between radio or television and being online will become increasingly moot over time. We call also for a policy where we can convert commercial corporate-run daily newspapers into what we call post-corporate newspapers, where they'll be low-profit, sort of like the Green Bay Packers football team, and eligible for subsidies, but still serving the entire communities, covering entire communities. So we don't have everyone who's going to separate websites to find out about their community. There's one place where the buck stops. If something's important, it'll be covered. And then we also call, finally, and I think this is what you're getting to in your question, we think there should be a voucher system where people can allocate money to any nonprofit website of their choice, as long as the website that gets the money will then use the money, is a nonprofit website, and anything it produces will go into the public domain and won't be protected by copyright, which will strongly encourage it to do journalism, because that's the least copyright-interested media content. And we think this way, all sorts of great websites people like to, where writers are struggling, where people can't pay the bills, well, finally, we have the way to publicly subsidize them without any government control over who gets the money, so we can have a rich public sphere well-subsidized, like the founders intended, without government censorship. It's really the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. And I gather it goes beyond, you know, supporting journalism and investigation and that kind of thoughtfulness. You also, a lot of people are talking about really enriching the public sphere, that is, and that's, in fact, then moves right into kind of the educational apparatus, where public affairs really have a much more important presence, and where people find it interesting and dramatic and begin, in fact, talking about politics again.
Well, that's what it's all about. I mean, we often talk about the importance of having journalism so you can have democracy. Well, every bit important is that you have to have democracy to have journalism. They go hand in hand. When you're in a society like ours, where we've really seen our politics detached from popular rule to a large extent, where corruption is endemic, where we're fighting endless wars and inequality is growing, journalism loses its mojo. It loses its reason for existence. And I think that's part of the reason journalism is in crisis, is that there's a broader political crisis. Democracy and journalism rise and fall together. And journalists aren't agnostic on the question. They shouldn't be, of whether we're a democratic society. They have to always be champions of democracy, because without a viable, credible democracy, they really just become courtiers to the powerful. And so anyone who's interested in democratic politics or politics for a more just and humane world has to make the battle for journalism central to their work. And anyone interested in journalism has to understand that ultimately it's a battle for a more just and humane world.
Bob McChesney, thanks so much for talking to us. Yours is a wonderful and important book. It's, in fact, your publisher and Bob McChesney and John Nichols, his co-author, made it available, made 5 copies of his book available to us for people pledging at KBOO. Thanks a lot, Bob, and we'll talk to you again. Next on The Old Mole, we're going back to programming Old Moles. Laurie Mercier and Fran Michel review Michael Moore's latest work, his film, Capitalism, A Love Story.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Laurie Mercier, as Bill said, to discuss Michael Moore's latest film, Capitalism, A Love Story. If you've seen any of Moore's films, you have an idea of the style. The documentary mixes archival footage, home movies, interviews, and stunts like Moore's attempts to make a citizen's arrest of the board of AIG or wrapping crime scene tape around Wall Street banks. Indicting capitalism, the film focuses on the economic crisis of the last 2 years, against the background of post-World War II prosperity and the wider sharing of wealth in the 1950s when the richest were taxed at 90%. It quotes a 2006 Citigroup memo analyzing the United States as a plutonomy functioning for the richest 1% and highlights the memo's suggestion that the plutonomy might be threatened by the 99% who are not the richest but who have more votes than the 1%. The film touches on predatory lending, foreclosures, evictions, unemployment, dead peasant insurance, a for-profit juvenile prison, the bank bailout, and the intimacy of the federal government with Goldman Sachs. Along the way, we hear capitalism praised or condemned by Cold War educational films or evicted former homeowners. A number of priests and a bishop are shown declaring that capitalism is not Christian, but is an evil that cannot be reformed. And we get footage from a biblical drama with Jesus redubbed to advocate free enterprise and refinancing your mortgage as an illustration of the propaganda we've been offered. So what do we think of the film's critique of capitalism? I think, despite what at least one review has said, this is not really a Marxist analysis of capitalism.
No, it's not a Marxist analysis, but certainly Moore has done more than any other popular filmmaker to draw attention to the failings of capitalism. And he marshals plenty of recent evidence from the bank bailouts to the callous treatment of the sick to underscore just how evil and unworkable it is. And I think even just including the word capitalism in the title of the film is radical because we're a society that refuses to acknowledge the forbidden C words, class and capitalism. And so Moore is really pushing the envelope, I think, in terms of what one finds in box office hits.
That's true, although there are limits that he does not push beyond. So, for instance, at the very end of the film, when he comes out and says that capitalism is a bad system, it's evil, it's got to end, it has to stop. And the alternative that we are invited to turn to is not socialism, but democracy. And so he does a kind of switch there and doesn't say the S word. He'll say capitalism is a problem, but he's not quite ready to come out and say what we need instead is socialism. And in fact, what he seems to be advocating is a kind of social welfare state or welfare capitalism, the sort of mixed economy that most of Europe has.
Although he does provide plenty of hints that socialism might be the preferable model. And in fact, he has a humorous scene where the right is trying to portray Obama as a socialist, and Moore shows how as the more he's called a socialist, the more his credibility climbs, especially among young people who seem interested in this idea of socialism.
And yet, paradoxically, although he does cite that poll result with young people thinking that socialism, about a third of the population thinks socialism is the best system, and fewer than that think capitalism is the best system. But he also notes in his section on Obama's election that as Obama became more and more popular and more likely to win the election, he got more and more money from Wall Street banks, that they were investing in their own future by buying the future president of the United States.
And so he's really underscoring how corrupt the system is, that capitalism is not just an economic system, it's embedded with the political, cultural system of this country. And that might be one of the flaws of the film in that he doesn't explain how or why people don't resist. I mean, we have lots of scenes of people in their misery enduring these foreclosures or unable to access health care. Moore is repeatedly juxtaposing what citizens of Europe and much of Asia have in the terms of a social welfare state. But why isn't there more resistance? Why don't people rise up against this system.
Well, he does. I mean, he does propose propaganda as one answer, or at least part of an answer. And the ways that, for instance, not only these sort of Cold War educational films that he has clips from, but popular culture is geared toward enforcing the idea that anyone can become rich. And there are, you know, shots of enormous mansions that a smaller figure than 1% of the population can own. And yet the idea is that anyone could make it. Anyone could become wealthy. And so we're all willing to sort of wait it out and hold on to that lottery sort of hope that we are going to be among the rich instead of among the vast and increasing numbers of poor and middle class, and increasingly the middle class getting smaller and smaller.
And he does provide some striking examples of alternative economies and alternative ways of organizing work and society. He has the great example of workers in a bakery, and I don't think he ever names the bakery, but workers there earn something like $60,000 a year. Management and employees collaborate on the production of their product and the making of bread. And it seems like this very ideal kind of workplace. And there's also another example of the engineering co-op, where the engineers who work together are all paid the same. They make decisions collectively. I mean, who wouldn't want to work in one of these places? So I think there are some models that are presented in subtle ways suggesting that a socialist democratic workplace is the model for us all.
Yeah, although he talks about it as workplace democracy. He says most workplaces are dictatorships, and somebody in charge tells everybody else what to do. And there are these few models of sort of democratic workplaces where everyone participates and then everyone shares economically in the profits that are made. So there are those examples. There's also the clip he has of FDR presenting his Economic Bill of Rights, which is essentially a list of sort of social welfare policies that everyone should have access to health care and education and housing and a decent job that will allow them to live with dignity. And, you know, there are a few other things that are all, as he points out, the kinds of advantages and rights that workers in Europe have gained and lots of other countries have, but the U.S. does not.
And I think I think he successfully incorporates some of these icons like FDR and Jesus and the idea of democracy as ways to bring in a larger audience to consider some kind of socialist system. Because as he, you know, reveals with some of his footage of Jesus and in interviews with many of these priests who emphasize how evil capitalism is, that this is not a model that Jesus or FDR would have advocated.
Indeed not. I mean, the film really is, if you are a fan at all of Michael Moore's films, I would say it's hilarious and moving by turns and sort of rousing by the end, although it's not entirely clear rousing to what end. We don't end with the sort of individualist suggestions you get at the end of something like An Inconvenient Truth. We don't just, like, go by socialist light bulbs at the end of this. But it's not entirely clear what we are supposed to do. But it certainly is a rousing film. And I'm planning to see it again, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd both encourage everyone to see it and drag your friends and family to see it as well.
And have critical discussions about what really are the alternatives and how we can move toward those. Because there's less, of course, in the film about that. Because it's an hour and a half film. He doesn't have time to, you know, sort of lay out an agenda.
Well, and I think it speaks to the dearth of social movements on the left and the vocabulary, as you pointed out earlier, that we have to even talk about alternatives to capitalism. So the fact that Moore ends the film somewhat abruptly, kind of referring to this vague notion of democracy is what we need, I think it's really up to us, to all of us, to mobilize and to become involved in various social movements that challenge this economic order and begin to represent and model alternatives.
And really, KBOO is one of those models, right? I mean, KBOO is one of the places where you can engage in social activism and find out information that will counter the propaganda that tells you that really what Jesus would have said to you is that you should refinance your mortgage. that there are other ways of looking at the world, and you can find them.
Yes.
by listening to KBOO.
And Jesus would have said to support KBOO radio, because this is where we can find the information and the activism and the inspiration to move ahead with some new tomorrow.
Thanks a lot for listening. Thanks to everybody. That's it for the Old Mole.